there's anything we're seeing right now in this very unusual moment in American history is conventional wisdom is no longer conventional.
Unpacking the results from last night in Michigan, the Senate primary was a nail biter. It's raising questions about who can win come November.
For Wednesday, August 5th, this is All Things Considered.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Ahead this hour, we question Senator Bernie Sanders about the future of the Democratic Party.
Also, Ariana Grande's appearance in a new video sparks debate about health and privacy.
But is her body any of our business?
The troubling part is that part of her art is her body and the way that she presents it to us.
And a Massachusetts museum goes viral for being the worst aquarium ever.
Everybody on the side of the street with big grins calling out to us saying, worst aquarium ever.
Inside joke after this news. Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Libby Casey. In Michigan, progressive Abdul El-Sayed has narrowly won the state's highly watched Democratic Senate primary. As Russ McNamara of the Michigan Public Radio Network reports, although funding was lopsided, it was the most expensive Senate primary ever.
And candidates who are looking to put working class Americans back at the heart of our politics. And that's our focus here in New York City. And just from what we're seeing in Michigan, it looks like that's what Michiganders want there to be their focus come November.
NPR's Sage Miller reports on how voters decided in other primary races around the country.
Progressive Democrats scored another win this election cycle when voters in Michigan's 7th congressional district picked Will Lawrence as their nominee. Democrats hope to flip the seat away from first-time Republican Congressman Tom Barrett. But establishment Democrats won in Missouri and Virginia. Missouri Congressman Wesley Bell beat progressive former Congresswoman Cori Bush. Despite a record low approval rating, Trump still has a strong grip on his party. The Trump-backed candidate won the Republican nomination in a congressional race in Washington state, and Trump's candidates also won in two races for governor in Kansas and Michigan. Sage Miller, NPR News.
President Trump is in Las Vegas. He's expected to speak at Red Rock Resort and Casino about the economy within the hour. The United Nations Human Rights Commissioner condemned a sharp increase in executions and death sentences in Iran since the beginning of the war. In a statement issued today, the UN official says Iran continues to use capital punishment to suppress dissent. NPR's Hadil Al-Shalchi reports.
UN Human Rights Chief Volker Turk said he was, quote, alarmed at the rise in executions and death sentences issued in Iran since the beginning of the U.S.-Israeli war. In a statement, he said that since March 19th, at least 56 people have been executed on national security-related charges, including 27 individuals in cases linked to January protests. Turk said 100 others are at risk of execution on similar charges. According to Turk, executions have, quote, reportedly been carried out in public, some only weeks after arrest. Turk called the death penalty, quote, incompatible with the right to life and human dignity. Hadil Al-Shalchi, NPR News, Istanbul.
The Senate has confirmed Dr. Erica Schwartz as director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The vote was along party lines today. Schwartz served as deputy surgeon general during the first Trump administration. She's the first permanent CDC director in almost a year. This is NPR News. Regular gas in the U.S. is still averaging more than $4 a gallon. Officials in Iran and Oman say they're getting close to an agreement on the Strait of Hormuz that could ease pressure on the global economy. Part of a SpaceX Falcon 9 rocket crashed into the moon earlier today. As Joe Palca reports, NASA estimated the impact would create a crater 60 feet across and 12 feet deep.
The Falcon 9 rocket left Earth in January of this year. It was carrying Firefly Aerospace's Blue Ghost 1 lunar lander. The rocket's upper stage wasn't intended to hit the moon, but it seems SpaceX never commanded it to maneuver so it would definitely miss the moon. The approximately 10,000-pound upper stage struck the moon, traveling at more than 5,000 miles per hour. According to NASA, meteoroids with similar energy hit the moon every 6 days or so. Amateur astronomer Bill Gray is credited with predicting the impact would occur using publicly available data. It will likely be days before telescopes on Earth and in orbit around the Moon are able to confirm the size of the impact crater. For NPR News, I'm Joe Palca.
Cooler weather and a break in the winds are allowing firefighters in Washington state to make progress on wildfires that are burning homes and forcing thousands of people to leave for safety. Today, some are being allowed to go back home in Spokane. But now there are concerns about air quality because of all the smoke. Alert warnings of unhealthy levels of air pollution are in effect across most of Washington and surrounding states. I'm Kristen Wright, NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include FJC, a foundation of donor-advised funds, working to maximize the impact of charitable giving and to create customized philanthropic solutions. Learn more at fjc.org.
You're listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. It is 4:06. I'm Jennifer Barr. Support comes from ICTV, providing information for and about Itasca County on Apple TV, Roku, and watchictv.org. Partly cloudy tonight, lows 55 to 60, and tomorrow sunny, highs 80 to 85. Southwest winds tomorrow 10 to 15, gusting higher and lows overnight in the low 60s, and by Friday, sunny, highs 74 to 80.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington, and we begin this hour with the fight for the future of the Democratic Party, a fight unfolding in primaries across the country, ballot after ballot, pitting moderate establishment candidates against progressives, like this guy.
What a race. You know, in the words of Muhammad Ali, we shook up the world.
That is Abdul Al-Sayed speaking to reporters this morning. Voters in Michigan just picked him as the Democratic nominee for the Senate. A huge primary win for progressives, although establishment candidates also picked up wins last night. So what are the takeaways here? A question we will put to Senator Bernie Sanders, independent from Vermont, self-described Democratic socialist who endorsed Al-Sayed. Senator, welcome back to All Things Considered.
Good to be with you.
How do you see the stakes in what happened in Michigan last night? Was this the most important test yet for where Democrats and the Democratic Party is headed?
I think maybe. I think it's important to appreciate the extraordinary victory that Abdul won last night. He took on the Michigan Democratic establishment, virtually all of them. He took on the national Democratic establishment. And most importantly, he took on, in what I think is unprecedented, I've never heard of this, close to $70 million in one state, the state of Michigan, from super PAC money, half of which were $30 million of which was from APAC.
And I want to talk about the money in just a second, but I do want to just push you. This was not a blowout. This was not the cakewalk that early polling suggested it might be. Why do you think not?
This is the most extraordinary victory in modern American politics. He took on everybody and over $60 million that he won by one vote would have been an extraordinary victory. In terms of polling, I don't know what to say about Michigan polling. They got to work on getting some better pollsters. I remember when I ran for president in 2016, they told me the pollster said you got a 99 to 1% chance of winning in Michigan. We won in Michigan. I think they need some new pollsters there.
Here's to better and good polling. Okay, on the money, how big a factor was APAC-affiliated money yesterday in Michigan?
It was huge. The fact that she lost speaks to Abdul's campaign and the fact that he had many, many thousands of people knocking on doors. The fact that he won does not mean that money does not play a role. I have never seen a campaign where so much money and so much establishment support went to the other candidate, and another candidate won.
Electability. We're talking about elections. We're talking about electability. As you know well, Senator Sanders, the conventional wisdom has been, you know, moderate Democrats are going to have a better shot at winning in the general election once they get past the primary because they might have a better shot at picking up undecided voters, swing voters, and so on. Does that conventional wisdom hold in 2026?
No, we're seeing, if there's anything we're seeing right now in this very unusual moment in American history is conventional wisdom is no longer conventional. It's out of touch with reality. what you're seeing, again, from all over this country, is people who have never run for office before, people who are trade unionists, iron workers suddenly running and winning primaries in Montana or in Ohio and so forth. The way you win elections, to my mind, is that you have to generate excitement. The American people now are very frustrated with the Democratic Party and the Republican Party and Donald Trump. They are hurting. They can't afford health care, they can't afford housing, can't afford a decent retirement. And they're looking around them and they're saying, is the government doing anything for me? And the answer is not much. And the reason for that is you have a corrupt campaign finance system and members of Congress can't stand up to the money. So when you have candidates, progressives going out and saying, you know what, I'm going to take on these guys. It is insane that we have more income and wealth inequality in America today than ever, that we're the only major country not to guarantee health care to all people or paid medical and family leave. You know what people are saying? Huh, maybe I will get involved. Maybe we can change what's going on in America. Maybe we can create a decent society.
Can you see a progressive, can you see a Democratic socialist winning the White House in 2028?
Sure, absolutely.
Who?
I'm not going to go. You know, one of the things that does bother me is that instead
try.
Of talking, you have to try. But we should be talking about why we're the only major country on earth not to guarantee health care to all people, not speculating on an election which is going to take place in 2.5 years. You know, I think we have endless campaigns.
But what happens right now is going to shape what's happening in 2028, surely.
No, but let's talk about it. I think as a nation, we need to focus. Why do we have the highest rate of childhood poverty of any major country? Why are we spending $1.1 trillion on the military, including billions for endless wars in support of Netanyahu? We need in a country to have a serious discussion about the very serious issues facing the American people. The political process will play out. Candidates will come up, they'll run. Some will do better than others. We'll see what happens. But I think 2.5 years before an election, it's a little bit silly to talk about candidates.
Last question. For many years, you've been pushing for universal health care. You've managed to do it multiple times in this conversation. Are we any closer?
Yeah, we are. Poll after poll makes it clear. The American people understand this system is broken. It is dysfunctional. It is insanely expensive. We spend twice as much per capita on health care as the people of other nations. But all over the world, they manage to guarantee health care to all people as a human right. The American people want Medicare for all. And if the Democrats gain control of the House and Senate, my top demand will be you pass Medicare for all within the next few months of your taking power.
Vermont Independent Senator Bernie Sanders speaking with us from his office on Capitol Hill. Senator, thank you.
Well, thank you very much.
Israel's army is warning of imminent collapse among some of its units because of an extreme shortage of troops, including among Israel's reservist army. Hundreds of reservists have publicly ignored summons for duty. Experts say that Israel's multiple war fronts are putting a huge mental and financial strain on fighters. NPR's Emily Feng has this story.
Frustration boiled over into anger among Israeli veterans this past July. They were in Israel's parliament to protest a proposed enlistment exemption for the country's ultra-Orthodox community. We were your bullet shields, former soldier Shamir Benita complains. And upon our return, you allowed our families to bear all the punishment of the war, Benita laments.
I think that Israel is very much a post-traumatic nation.
Dr. Oren Tenning is a psychiatrist whose specialties include treating soldiers like Benita, who now advocates for other veterans with PTSD. Tenning treats people who go through repeated traumatic experiences, like reservists called up again and again, and the constant wars that Israel's been in since a deadly Hamas attack on October 7th, 2023.
People find it hard to even connect to these basics of life after this terrible but very exciting experience they encounter for so long. It's not like a week of battle and going back. It's month and month and month.
More than a third of reservists are parents. Many are on duty for more than 100 days a year, and they leave families and businesses behind when at war.
We've had families who've contacted us because they didn't know what to do.
This is Sharon Levin, a director at Pamanim, which provides free financial counseling services. More and more of the people her organization helps are reservists and their families.
It's how to carry on life when you know that you're going to be in the reserves for like 60 days or 90 days a year, and you're in and out, so how do we deal with that kind of uncertainty?
For Levin, the work supporting reservists is also personal.
At one point a couple of months ago, I had 4 out of my 5 kids in the army.
Israel is now cutting back the number of reservists it calls up. But the current military chief of staff, Ayel Zamir, warned this spring of, quote, red flags, a shortage of about 12,000 full-time soldiers. Major General Uzi Dayan, once head of the military's planning branch, is familiar with mobilization issues.
Okay.
First, though, he proudly shows me his lush backyard, where one of his daughters got married last year, right before the 12-day war with Iran.
In 1 o'clock in the morning, we went to the shelter, and the groom is a pilot, and he went. In this very night, he flew to Tehran.
So when I ask him about Israel's soldiers being tired, he says, tough. Growing up, his fellow soldiers always asked, until when can we stop fighting?
And you know what was the answer of my generation? As much as needed.
At the turn of the millennium, Israel was withdrawing from war fronts. But over the past 3 years, Israel's conflicts and wars have expanded in Gaza, Lebanon, Syria, and this year with Iran. So Dayan believes Israel's army needs to grow, boost recruitment of full-time soldiers, forcibly enlist the ultra-Orthodox citizens of Israel who are exempted now from service. And he says this is all necessary because he wants to reoccupy Gaza.
The only way to deter a terror organization is to threat its own existence, its basic existence.
There are critics in Israel of this war-first approach, influential ones. Among them, Ami Ayalon, former head of the Shin Bet intelligence agency. After years of surveilling Palestinians and Israelis, he came to believe that force cannot be the only answer to eliminating threats like Hamas.
You cannot deter a person or a group of people if they believe that they have nothing to lose. Unless we shall create a way for them to understand that they can achieve the end of occupation and a Palestinian state alongside Israel, they will not surrender.
But support for this view in Israel, of a Palestinian state existing next to the state of Israel, is vanishingly small now. Support for continued war against Israel's enemies in Lebanon and Iran is overwhelmingly high. But the question remains, who will fight these wars? Emily Fang, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
18 minutes after 4 o'clock, thanks for listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. In a moment, our daily dose of phonology. Support comes from Patterson's Clothing in downtown Bemidji, an apparel retailer serving the Northwood since 1930. Patterson's features clothing from brands such as Cool, Patagonia, Darn Tough, and Smart Wool. Patterson'sClothing.com. Our lows tonight, 55 to 60, and tomorrow, sunny, highs 80 to 85. Winds from the southwest, 10 to 15, gusting higher.
On today's date, August 5th, in the year 2001, and again in the year 2005, I am allowed to be a party to a huge gathering of monarch butterflies. They gather in the fall, preparatory to migration, and on every possible branch, there are hundreds of monarch butterflies just hanging out. Both of these observations occurred late in the afternoon, and both involved uncounted hundreds of monarch butterflies. This is the generation of butterflies that will move to Mexico and will overwinter there and then begin the return flight to the Northland, only to be supplanted by their children, their children's children, and their children's children's children. Eventually, they'll be back here and we will enjoy their presence throughout the summer.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Progressive Insurance, committed to helping homeowners compare and choose home insurance from a network of companies in one place with Home Quote Explorer. Learn more at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. And from DuckDuckGo, a private search engine and browser. DuckDuckGo believes AI should be optional and private. Now with Duck.ai, users can chat privately with AI. Learn more at Duck.ai.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Last week, pop star Ariana Grande released a music video for the title track of her new album called Petal.
Trying to feel some real to cry again. They say the artist needs tears to write again.
The video had the internet buzzing, but less about the song, more about the way Ariana Grande looks. She appears extremely thin, sunken cheeks, her ribs and her collarbones protruding from her chest. Widespread commentary about her health ensued, and within days, Grande announced she will be, quote, taking a step back from visibility after she completes her summer tour, although she later added this was planned a long time ago. It does all prompt an uncomfortable question. Is Ariana Grande's body any of our business? Monica Hesse asked just that in a column for The Washington Post, and she joins us now. Hi there.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Start with the question as you frame it. Is Ariana Grande's body our business?
So this is a conversation I would so rather not be having. I'm sure you would rather not be having, because in general, I think that the safe and reliable answer is that no, nobody's body or the way they appear is any of our business. It doesn't affect us. But this video, which had a shocking appearance, caused such a groundswell of support or confusion or defensiveness or alarm that it's clear this is a conversation that we want to have, even as we're not sure how to have it.
You had a line in your piece where you write, her body isn't our business, I'm paraphrasing, but how it affects us, how we react to it, that is our business.
Yeah, I mean, the way that I think of it is Ariana Grande is an artist, and art is designed to provoke reactions and conversation in people. The troubling part is that part of her art is her body and the way that she presents it to us, and that just leads to a really thorny mess.
Yeah. I mean, she is, as I noted, she's a massive pop star. She's had number one singles. She stars in both Wicked movies. Does that factor into the conversation? Should it factor into the conversation? The message that her appearance may be sending to other young women for whom she's a role model?
I think that it does. We all know that society and culture go through trends in terms of what we view as the ideal body or an appealing body, from the more voluptuous supermodels of the 80s to the heroin chic models of the 90s to Kim Kardashian tiny waist big booty of the 2000s to these discussions that we're having about Ozempic. So I think that it is normal to wonder whether Ariana Grande's body, which, to say off the bat, we have no idea what's going on with her size, with her health, with anything that's prompted the way that she appears. But we do know that we as a culture go through cycles that are influenced by the people that we look up to.
Just to elaborate on that, she has not come out and commented on what's going on here. So as you note, we don't know what's happening. Does she owe the public an explanation?
I don't think that she does owe the public an explanation, but given the fact that her career and her livelihood is built by her fans, I don't think that it's reasonable for her to ask that people have no opinion on her physical appearance and on how she presents. And I also think that in a vacuum of information, people will create the stories that make sense to them about what might be going on.
I mean, I have to ask, would we be talking about this if a male pop star dropped a video and looked really, really thin?
You know, I was thinking about that a little bit in the context of Chadwick Boseman, the star of Black Panther, who had become just extremely thin before his death. Of course, he passed away, and we later learned that what had been going on is he was very ill. He had cancer and chose not to share that with us publicly. We really do never know what's happening with anyone's body. At the same time, women's bodies are held up for public consumption on a level that is just eons greater than male bodies are held up for public consumption. Historically and currently, we still have a much more judgmental attitude towards women's bodies, and we feel much freer to comment on them.
Monica Hesse, she's a screens critic for the Washington Post. Thank you for having an uncomfortable conversation.
We'll all muddle through it together.
Dr. Erica Schwartz will be the next director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. She was confirmed by the Senate today in a vote that was almost entirely along party lines. NPR's Ping Wong has more.
Schwartz faced tough questions in her confirmation hearing last month. Senator Bill Cassidy, a Republican from Louisiana who chairs the Influential Health Committee, pressed her on whether she would withstand political pressure. He ultimately voted to support her nomination.
After speaking with Dr. Schwartz again after the hearing, reviewing the transcript, and speaking to those who have served with her and know her well, I'm confident that she knows what she is doing and will stand against those who do not.
But most Democrats and independents were not convinced. Senator Bernie Sanders, an independent from Vermont, praised her credentials, but said he did not think she was prepared to stand up to Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who was cast out on the safety of long-used vaccines.
I think the American people are owed better than what President Trump has nominated.
Many in the public health community shared the sentiment. But Dr. Georges Benjamin, head of the American Public Health Association, says Schwartz navigated the confirmation process like a pro.
Public health people in our positions often have to manage through influence. And you don't get through influence by disagreeing with your boss publicly before you even got the job.
Now that she has the job, Benjamin says she's got real challenges ahead, including those created by the actions of the Trump administration.
The CDC's influence has diminished dramatically since they've taken over. You have to verify what is said. We never had to do that before.
Schwartz is the second CDC director to be Senate confirmed following the passage of a 2023 law. The first, Susan Menarez, served for less than a month before being fired by Kennedy last August. Dr. Dimitri Daskalakis, a former top official at the CDC, says many career scientists have left and political appointees have taken charge.
My advice to her is to look in her office of the director and make sure that the people that she has there are actually looking after science and the health of the American people rather than the interests of the secretary.
Secretary Kennedy has been critical of the agency and dismissive of its scientific expertise.
I really wish her luck in her new role, but I would also say it's not about the job, it's about the public health mission, and that needs to be her focus.
In her confirmation hearing, Schwartz pledged to put science first.
My sacred responsibility is to provide the American people with public health guidance that is clear, honest, and evidence-based.
Schwartz will be sworn into the role in the next few days. Ping Huang, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
Thank you for listening to People Powered KAXE and All Things Considered from National Public Radio. I'm Jennifer Barr. In a moment, National Native News, and 1 hour from now, it's the Up North Report, local news from our region. Support comes from Bridget's Pub in downtown Bemidji, serving Irish and American food, offering Monday night trivia at 6:30 plus open mic on Thursday, also at 6:30, more on Facebook. And we thank L&M Fleet Supply for their support, carrying a variety of products for your next outdoor adventure with 13 locations across the Northland. More at lmsupply.com. Partly cloudy tonight, lows 55 to 60, southwest wind up to 20 miles per hour. Sunny tomorrow with highs 80 to 85. Winds from the southwest 10 to 15 with higher gusts. And partly cloudy tomorrow night with lows in the low 60s and a slight chance of showers and thunderstorms. By Friday, sunny, highs 74 to 80. Time for National Native News on KAXE.
This is National Native News. I'm Jill Freitas. The states that share the Colorado River have a new federal framework in place for managing the embattled waterway. But as KNAU's Chris Clemens reports, the impacts of the Fed strategy on tribal nations is less clear.
The new framework from the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation could result in steep cuts to the Central Arizona Project, a delivery system for Colorado River water. That worries some tribal leaders like Orlando Carroll, chairman of the White Mountain Apache Tribe in eastern Arizona.
We definitely would be concerned of any cutbacks that are generated.
Under a federal settlement, Carroll's tribe can lease its share of water from the river. But at least his tribe's water rights have been spelled out. Other tribes, like the Navajo, Hopi, and San Juan Southern Paiute, are watching the feds put out a Colorado River management plan for the states while their own water rights in Arizona remain unquantified. Brenda Jesus is a Navajo Nation Council delegate.
I just don't understand that they've gotten their water rights decree, yet in the year 2026, the Navajo Nation doesn't have any.
A settlement to give the Navajo Nation its water rights in Arizona is still under consideration in Congress. For KNAU, I'm Chris Clements in Flagstaff.
Golden King crab season opened August 1st in the Aleutian Islands. This year, the total allowable catch for the region is 13% higher than it was last season. Ethan Nichols is an area management biologist with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game based in Dutch Harbor. He says this reflects a sizable increase for the western area of the fishery at over 1.5 million pounds this season.
The quota in the east this year is a very slight decrease from last season. It's down 4%. In the western area, it's a large increase this year. It's a 79% increase.
Due to the size of the fishery, it's split into different management areas, one east of Atka and the other to the west, each with their own harvest levels.
The east has more fishable depths or more fishable grounds as you get further west and much smaller islands that drop off quicker.
That means better fishing in the eastern area. Even with a slight decrease in allowable catch this year, the eastern area's limit is still more than double that of the west limit at over 3 million pounds. Nichols says he's optimistic about the upcoming season.
I think it's a really unique crab fishery, just where the fishing occurs, it being a deep water fishery from a select few vessels, and I'm excited about the coming season.
Just four vessels are expected to fish for Golden King crab this season. The fishery was worth $29.5 million at the dock last year, according to preliminary figures from Fish and Game. This year's season ends next April. This story was provided by KUCB's Katie Ruther. Tribal historic preservation leaders are voicing concerns over proposed changes to the federal review process for projects that could affect sacred sites and cultural resources. The Advisory Council on Historic Preservation voted to advance a proposed rule revising Section 106 of the National Historic Preservation Act, a key law requiring federal agencies to consider impacts on historic properties and consult with tribal nations. The National Association of Tribal Historic Preservation Officers says the proposal would weaken tribal consultation, narrow protections for places of religious and cultural significance, and give federal agencies greater authority over the review process. The proposal now heads to federal review before it's published for public comment. I'm Jill Freitas.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support for law and justice-related programming provided by Hobbs, Strauss, Dean & Walker, LLP, a national law firm dedicated to promoting and defending tribal rights for over 40 years. More information available at HobbsStrauss.com.
Okay, tribal colleges.
Hear that? Tribal college faculty do so much, one can't say it all here. Nothing but respect. Visit mosttheorjobdescription.com. The American Indian College Fund supports this program.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Procter & Gamble, maker of Metamucil. Made with psyllium, a plant-based fiber that helps support digestive health by trapping and removing waste. Designed to be taken every day. Learn more at metamucil.com. From Fisher Investments. As a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
From NPR News, it's All Things Considered. I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. The Food and Drug Administration is mulling whether to approve the first mRNA flu vaccine. Now, this decision is being closely watched because of the Trump administration's hostility towards mRNA technology in the wake of the COVID pandemic. NPR health correspondent Rob Stein joins us now to explain the details. Hi, Rob.
Hey there.
Hey, okay, so say more about why there is so much scrutiny over this particular vaccine. Like, what's the context here?
Yeah, sure. As you probably remember, President Trump embraced mRNA technology during his first term. Mm-hmm. His Operation Warp Speed developed the COVID-19 vaccines in record time to protect people during the pandemic.
Right.
An achievement that was widely praised as a medical triumph. It raised hopes that this powerful mRNA technology could be a game changer for protecting people against many other diseases. But mRNA vaccines ended up being vilified by many. And during the second Trump administration, Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr., a longtime vaccine critic, and other top health officials have been hostile towards mRNA technology. They made it harder to get the COVID vaccines. They slashed hundreds of millions of dollars of funding to develop new mRNA vaccines. And the FDA under Kennedy initially refused to even consider this new mRNA flu vaccine, which is called Emflusiva.
Okay, so then what changed? Like, what happened after that?
An intense backlash to that decision prompted the FDA to reverse course, and independent advisors voted unanimously in June to recommend that the FDA approve the shot. That was based on research involving more than 40,000 people conducted by Moderna, which makes the vaccine. The research found that Emflusiva appears to be safe and can apparently produce stronger protection than traditional flu vaccines for people ages 50 to 65.
Huh, I fall into that category. Okay, so much zigzagging. How does this vaccine work exactly?
Yeah, it works just like the COVID shots. Genetic material called mRNA kind of tricks the immune system into thinking a virus has invaded the body, triggering the production of antibodies to fend off the invader. In this case, it's the flu viruses instead of the coronavirus that causes COVID. Public health and infectious disease experts are also excited about this because mRNA vaccines can be updated and produced much more quickly than traditional flu vaccines, and that could make it more protective when a new flu virus emerges unexpectedly, like it did last season, and could be crucial if a flu pandemic erupts. I talked about this with Dr. Jeannie Morazzo. She leads the Infectious Disease Society of America.
The FDA would be signaling openness to this platform, which has been a controversy and an issue. It's a really promising product that could set us up not only for improved response to a bad flu season, but also to an improved response to any biological threats.
But, you know, others disagree. Dr. Brian Hooker is the chief scientific director of Children's Health Defense, an anti-vaccine group once headed by RFK Jr. He says the mRNA technology is just still too new.
Flu shots are given to healthy individuals, they're given to sick individuals, they're given to immunocompromised individuals. Ultimately, the approval could go to children. It could be for pregnant women. I would rather go back, fill in the gaps, dot the I's, cross the T's, and then roll forward with technology that has been tested over years and years and years.
All right, that is NPR's Rob Stein. Thank you so much, Rob.
You bet.
A small Texas law firm with ties to the Trump administration has been awarded a $150 million contract to represent migrant children in the country without guardians. The contract was awarded after the Trump administration stopped paying a network of about 100 legal nonprofits. They had previously done the work. Joining me from Texas to discuss this, NPR immigration correspondent Sergio Martinez Beltran. Hi, Sergio.
Hey.
Just ground us here. Why is the government paying to represent these children?
Yeah, well, this has been a legal requirement stretching back decades because of fears that children crossing the border alone could be easily exploited, abused, or trafficked. Now, the legal network you mentioned was made up of hundreds of attorneys and had been representing thousands of unaccompanied children in the government program. And these attorneys and nonprofit organizations are all across the country. But that contract expired, and the organization that had it, Acacia Center for Justice in D.C., said they declined a new one because it required attorneys to provide confidential information about the children, including legal strategy. Hmm. The lawyers say that would go against attorney-client privilege.
So enter this small Texas law firm. Who are they? And I guess we know about this because of a government notice that will be published.
Right. And the law firm listed in that notice is Burke Law Group. They are based in Houston, and it's supposed to last until August of next year, that contract. Now, according to the law firm's website, it specializes in advising companies on complex environmental, regulatory, and enforcement matters. Out of 24 attorneys, only two specialize in immigration and asylum cases, according to the website. Burke Law Group will be in charge of at least 1,800 cases of children in shelters, according to a nonprofit that previously represented the kids. Now, it's unclear who will represent the thousands of children outside of shelters.
Sounds like a mismatch in numbers between attorneys mm-hmm. and the children. What are the nonprofits who were representing the children saying about this?
You know, immigrant rights advocates are questioning this decision. Roxana Avila Compañu is the deputy director of the Florence Immigrant and Refugee Rights Project, one of the nonprofit organizations providing services to the unaccompanied children. In a news conference today, she said this is the worst they've seen the government treating unaccompanied children.
Instead of taking care of these children, the government is instead implementing things such as awarding a contract to a private small law firm in Texas with no discernible experience in relevant immigration law or child welfare.
Avila Compañu says this will result in the deportation of many children because they might not have adequate representation. Now, we tried to get a hold of Burke Law Group for comment. They did not respond to our multiple phone calls and emails.
Didn't want to comment. Okay, but you have been digging around. What else should we know about this law firm?
Well, that it has ties to the Trump administration. Marcella Burke is the founder of Burke Law Group. According to her LinkedIn page, she served as deputy general counsel of the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency during the first Trump administration. Burke did not respond to her request for comment either, and the Department of Health and Human Services, which is the agency that would award the contract, did not respond to specific questions about this decision either.
Hey, can I just recenter our conversation on the people most affected by this, the unaccompanied minors in the system? These are kids. What else do we know?
Yeah, we're talking about children, some who are so young that they can't even speak and they have to go to court. And without adequate representation, it is almost guaranteed that kids will be deported. And I say this because there will technically be a 2-week gap in services. The proposed start date for Burke Law Group isn't until mid-August. So this has left the old service providers feeling responsible for their legal representation of the kids. They said today they will continue to offer their services essentially for free, at least for now, or until they completely lose all the few resources they have left.
NPR immigration correspondent Sergio Martinez Beltran. Thank you, Sergio.
You're welcome.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 4:44. Thanks for listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. Just ahead, North Star Stories, news from throughout the state of Minnesota from Ampers. Coming up at 5:30, the Up North Report, local news from the KAXE news team. Support comes from Bemidji Brewing, featuring Sunset Sounds, live and local music on the patio from 6 to 8 p.m. on alternating Saturdays this summer. Bemidji Beer, nice catch. And we thank Dale's Auto Body, serving the auto body needs of Grand Rapids and surrounding communities since 1984, performing auto body and collision repair as well as auto glass replacement, dedicated to getting you back on the road after an accident. More information at dalesautobodyinc.com. Minnesota's primary election is Tuesday, August 11th. Early voting is open now. The KAXE news team has put together a primary election guide. Learn more about the candidates running to represent you. Visit kaxe.org/election guide.
You are listening to North Star Stories, voices from where we live, a daily newscast about what it means to live in Minnesota.
With headlines from around the state, I'm Zan Holston.
What we need right now is every county commissioner and every St. Paul council member to publicly say, just give us more time. We need time to save lives. We need time to mitigate the harm that these sweeps are going to cause.
Community members pleaded with the St. Paul City Council yesterday to delay the clearing of Pig's Eye Regional Park's homeless encampments. The first sweep is set to begin today. The city and Ramsey County say they have $1 million in aid and 49 emergency shelter beds for the 124 people counted at the camp. Advocates say the true number is much higher, shelters are already full, and waiting lists are massive. Outreach coordinator David Manicki says most of the unhoused will simply move to smaller, more isolated sites.
These people are scared now, and most of them are thinking of simply moving from one tent to another tent, because there isn't enough place for them to go.
The city says fires, assaults, thefts, and two overdose deaths make the camps unsafe. Staff say they're trying to connect the unhoused with shelter, treatment, or housing. Pig's Eye is the first of three large encampments the city plans to clear. It has not announced dates for the other two. The Minnesota GOP itself has not announced a Sharia law caucus, but Republican State Senator Michael Holmstrom is creating what he calls a Sharia-free Minnesota caucus. The Buffalo lawmaker from northwest of Minneapolis says it will push legislation aimed at keeping Islamic religious law from influencing state courts. Holmstrom says the group will reaffirm the state and U.S. constitutions as the highest legal authority. He has not named any other members. The cameras watching Minnesota drivers are now becoming targets themselves. In Faribault, south of the Twin Cities, prosecutors say a man who believed a Flock camera was tracking him cut it down last week, tried to have it taken apart at a workshop, then brought it home and taped over its lens. In Winona, in southeastern Minnesota, someone destroyed all eight of the city's cameras over the weekend. Cities ranging from Duluth, Plymouth, Eden Prairie, Edina, and Minnetonka have also reported cameras cut down or otherwise vandalized since May. Police have not linked the cases and don't know the motives, but the pattern resembles a broader national backlash. As of Tuesday, only Faribault police have announced an arrest. In central Minnesota, Brainerd Public Schools is reviewing how it responds to bullying reports after the deaths of two Forest View Middle School students this summer. The mother of one student says her daughter, who was black, was bullied about her skin tone and appearance. The district has called for an independent review, while the school board has held emergency work sessions and discussions about its response and future policy. Victoria McQuain Creek runs Onyx Collective, a group supporting black people living in rural Minnesota. She told North Star Stories that racialized bullying can be reinforced when bystanders aren't empowered to speak up.
Whether it is the silence of those of us who experienced racialized bullying or silence from those who may have witnessed it and just didn't know what to do.
Hear the full conversation in this week's special half-hour edition of North Star Stories addressing teen bullying and suicide.
When one of the candidates is speaking, pretty please with sugar on top. Let them finish what they're saying.
A call for civility opened an enthusiastic and crowded Farm Fest annual agriculture forum near Morgan in southwestern Minnesota. Candidates and office holders face questions about the future of farming.
Should the federal government play a bigger role in defending crop protection manufacturers?
The questions come as farmers face low crop prices, rising fuel and fertilizer costs, and falling global demand and income. The Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis says 9 out of 10 Minnesota agricultural lenders reported decreasing farm incomes this year. State and U.S. representatives, office holders and challengers, took the stage yesterday. Candidates for governor in U.S. Senate debate today. FarmFest runs through tomorrow. And finally, two Minnesota favorites are getting a taste of national attention. Snarky Loon Brewing in Jenkins, north of Brainerd, has been filmed for America's Best Restaurants Roadshow, a TV series featuring its food, beer, and community focus. And for dessert, Cup and Cone in White Bear Lake, northeast of St. Paul, has won America's Best Ice Cream. The soft serve stand beat 63 shops in a 5-round fan vote. Come for the lakes, stay for the calories. For North Star Stories, I'm Zan Holston.
North Star Stories is produced by Amherst, Minnesota's community radio stations, with support from the state of Minnesota, online at amherst.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. 2024 was the year that rocked college sports. 2 years ago, the NCAA agreed to pay $2.8 billion to settle antitrust claims with student athletes. And that launched the era of student athletes personally making money for their name, image, and likeness. Now the NCAA is looking for help on Capitol Hill to make college sports financially solvent in the aftermath of that settlement. Schools argued that the settlement money wasn't enough to attract the best athletes. So Congress came through with a bipartisan bill called the Protect College Sports Act. If this bill passes, it will allow the larger, wealthier schools to spend more money to attract the best athletes to their teams. Ross Dellinger is a senior reporter with Yahoo Sports and joins us now to explain the details. Welcome to All Things Considered.
Great to be on.
Back in 2024, the NCAA and Power Five athletic conferences agreed to pay this $2.8 billion to settle a bunch of antitrust claims. And as part of that settlement, conferences and schools would start sharing revenue, right, with student athletes directly. And that sharing allowed these direct payments. So can you explain what problems did that settlement create and what is the Protect College Sports Act trying to fix?
Number one, by bringing revenue to the athletes directly from the schools. Previously, the athletes were paid basically by boosters for the most part in businesses, and it was right. A little unruly and all that. So the settlement sort of shifted the money from boosters to the school to directly pay, and they set a cap. It's around $20 million, has a $20 million cap each school to pay their all of their athletes, so not just right. football, but all of their athletes. Well, what happened was, in no surprise, the schools that are always looking for a competitive advantage have gone over the cap because the name, image, and likeness endorsement commercial deals that athletes can get, they don't count against the cap. So basically what happened is schools arrange their boosters and booster collectives, which are groups of boosters, to go in other entities, corporate sponsors, other contractually affiliated businesses with a school. The school got those entities to pay athletes to go above the cap with sort of compensation disguised as endorsement and commercial opportunities. So the schools are going above the cap.
Got it. So it just returned everybody to this unruly situation again, this free-for-all.
Yes.
Okay, so then how does this bill, the Protect College Sports Act, try to fix some of those problems that you're describing?
The NCAA 7 years ago began lobbying Congress to fix some of these issues. And finally, we have a bill that is sort of on the brink of a vote on the Senate floor. And basically, the bill would limit transfer movement. So athletes would have one time to transfer, and then they'd have to sit out as a penalty if they transfer any subsequent times.
Okay.
So it would limit the transfer movement. It would limit eligibility to 5 years, and it would also ban professional players from returning to college, which has happened as well. And then the cap, the compensation cap, it would handle that too. It raises the cap. I mentioned earlier that each school has $20 million to spend on their athletes.
Yeah.
It raises the cap to closer to $50 million, which is the market. So now they're saying, okay, all of these entities that you're using to go above the cap now count against the cap. So in theory, the smaller programs will have a little bit of more of a shot maybe to compete according to the bill. So if that's closed as a harder cap, yes, the cap is higher, but there's a stricter cap, more like the NFL as opposed to the MLB.
Got it. Well, you mentioned the NFL. I mean, I feel like we're having this conversation in the first place because college sports is becoming more and more professional, right? Instead of just part of some educational experience for these athletes. And I'm wondering if college sports continues to move towards professional sports, what is lost?
Just 10 years ago, maybe even 5 years ago, college sports administrators talked often about academic progress in graduation rates. Well, guess what? You don't hear any of that anymore. You just don't. So already you're seeing the tether between universities in major college football programs sort of stretched, and we're getting closer and closer to it popping. By the way, the settlement in the congressional bill is sort of just a way to avoid collective bargaining, which is what the NFL, of course, has. Mm-hmm. And that's probably at the end of the road. Eventually, collective bargaining and employment probably will be coming to major college football.
Ross Dellinger is a senior reporter with Yahoo Sports. Thank you so much for clarifying all of this.
Yeah, it's great to be on. Thank you for having me.
And now a story about making lemonade out of lemons.
We like to say here in New Bedford and at the Whaling Museum, we have big things.
That is Amanda McMullen, president of the New Bedford Whaling Museum in coastal Massachusetts.
So we have 5 very sizable whale skeletons. We have 1 humpback whale, a teenage blue whale.
Also a full fiberglass replica of a blue whale heart. Visitors can actually climb into it.
The most has been 9 teenagers have been able to actually get within the entire whale heart.
You could say they have got a lot of heart. There's also one of the largest replicas of a ship in the world, a significant collection of scrimshaw art, artifacts from all over the Atlantic and the Caribbean regions. You know, it's kind of something for everyone, or almost everyone.
It was in 2020. It was actually during the pandemic. And this review actually landed on our Google review. And it was an individual who gave us 1 star. And they said simply, worst aquarium ever. And we immediately thought it was hysterical.
Hysterical because the New Bedford Whaling Museum did not have an aquarium. Then about a year ago, the museum's visitor experience manager had an idea.
The pitch was, I'm going to put this 1-star review on a t-shirt. She pitched it and we all said, you got to run with that.
Genius. The t-shirt became a viral hit on social media. Orders are now in the thousands and growing.
We have had orders from all 50 states except for Idaho.
What's up, Idaho? And the city of New Bedford seems on board as well. Recently, museum staff marched in a local parade.
We had everybody on the side of the street with big grins calling out to us saying, worst aquarium ever.
Yeah, but plot twist, the museum has since added a 250-gallon saltwater tank with local marine life, think crabs, sea stars, pufferfish. Technically, you know, a small aquarium. When the museum recently posted a restock of its worst aquarium ever merch, it wrote, so this is awkward.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Odoo, a platform dedicated to being flexible and bringing every part of business together, from CRM to inventory. Learn more about Odoo at odoo.com/NPR. From Sleep Number, offering the new Comfort Next Lux, which has the goal of delivering targeted pressure relief where it's needed most. Available at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com. From the Andrew Carnegie Foundation, formerly Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. And from the Public Welfare Foundation.
It is a minute before 5 o'clock. Thank you for listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley, Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker, celebrating 50 years of people-powered radio in northern Minnesota, and you can join us at kaxe.org. I'm Jennifer Barr. Stay tuned for another hour of All Things Considered from National Public Radio, plus the Up North Report, local news from our region at 5:30. 6 o'clock, As It Happens, news from a Canadian perspective. And 7 o'clock tonight, On the River, a great mix of music. Your volunteer host is DJ DeMurph. Tonight's weather, partly cloudy, lows 55 to 60, southwest wind gusting up to 20 miles per hour. Sunny tomorrow.